I'm Stephen Hundley from IUPUI, and this is Leading Improvements in Higher Education, a service of the Assessment Institute in Indianapolis. Our sponsor for this season is Watermark. In this episode, we talk with two leaders of HBCU CEQA, Mark Howes and Verna Orr. HBCU CEQA stands for the Historically Black Colleges and Universities Collaborative for Excellence in Educational Quality Assurance. Mark Howes is chair of HBCU CEQA and is the Associate Vice President of Institutional Effectiveness at the Morehouse School of Medicine. Verna Orr is co-chair of HBCU CEQA and is a postdoctoral research associate at the National Institute for Learning Outcomes Assessment. Verna and Mark profile HBCU CEQA's important work in this episode of Leading Improvements in Higher Education. I'm so happy we have Verna Orr and Mark Howes with us today to talk about the HBCU Collaborative for Excellence in Educational Quality Assurance, or HBCU CEQA. HBCU CEQA is a new affiliate of the Assessment Institute. And Mark, Verna, welcome to the program.
Thank you so much, Stephen, for having us.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, the pleasure is mine, and I'm looking forward to our conversation today. Let's begin, before we dive into talking about HBCU CEQA, let's first begin with the two of you. Mark, we'll start with you about a little bit about your background. Tell us who Mark is and how you got to your current role. What led you to your current role?
Good morning again, Stephen. Thank you again for the opportunity to be here. I was born in Nashville, Tennessee, and grew up in the city of Nashville. Spent some time in the country parts of Nashville as well. But I went to undergraduate school at Middle Tennessee State University in Murfreesboro, Tennessee, where I double majored in aerospace technology and mathematics. And then went on to earn my master's at MTSU as well and became interested in education. So I got a master's degree in mathematics and also got a master's degree in education as well. After that, I went to the Florida State University in Tallahassee, Florida, where I earned my doctorate in curriculum and instruction with emphasis in mathematics education. And I had plans of going on to be a college professor teaching teachers, which is something that I did in my early career, both at Florida State. And then I went on to teach at FAMU, with Florida Agricultural Mechanical University there in Tallahassee, Florida. After working there for several years, I worked at various universities and schools in the education department and got very interested in assessment work. And so I started doing a lot of assessment work, and then I eventually ended up working at Bethune-Cookman University in Daytona, Florida. And then after leaving there, I went back to Florida A&M and worked there for a while as the director of assessment there for the university. And after some time there, and where I am now at the Morehouse School of Medicine here in Atlanta, Georgia, where I serve as the Associate Vice President of Institutional Effectiveness and the Director of Outcomes and Assessment here at the medical school.
Mark, thanks so much. Verna, your background and what led you to your current role?
Well, thank you again, Stephen. I don't know if I said thank you appropriately enough earlier. Thanks so much for your support with regard to CEQA, our founding and where we are today. I have a pretty different background. So I have a performing arts background, right? I graduated from a performing arts high school in Jacksonville, Florida, where my family still resides. Did my undergraduate degree in Washington, D.C. at Howard University. I was a music education major, and after graduation, I became a music teacher. So I taught music for about 5 years in Washington, D.C. public schools. Went back to Howard University to pursue a master's degree because I had aspirations to be a leader in public schools, K-12 administration. So in that role, not in that role, but once I got my master's degree, I got a role as a school administrator. So I was responsible for 3 middle schools, and they were feeder schools into 1 high school. So I basically worked with principals and administrators on the transition between middle school and high school, which really kind of sparked my interest with regard to leadership in K-12. At the same time, I had to do an internship to complete my master's degree. And I chose to intern with a woman who was a senior vice president at a university. And from that experience, my research and professional goals shifted very, very swiftly. And I'll tell you why. So during the time of my internship, the president of that university decided that he was leaving. And it was pretty a pretty abrupt decision. And so a large part of my responsibilities during that internship was researching presidential transition. I didn't even know that was a profession, right? So over and over again, I saw that leaders of higher education institutions, colleges, universities, were white, 60-year-old Catholic, married men. And from my experiences as a performing artist, if something doesn't look like me, I ask the question, why? And I didn't have aspirations to be a leader, but if I wanted to be a leader of a college or university, I checked off none of those boxes. I'm not white. I'm not a man. I'm not Catholic. I'm not married. So what does that mean for people like me? And so that really is what kind of shifted my research interest to pursue higher education leadership. And with doing that, I pursued a doctorate at Howard University in K-12 administration and policy. Now, from that doctorate, I actually shifted at the same time of pursuing the doctorate from K-12 to higher education, where I was actually the right hand to university president, actually my alma mater's president, Howard University. I was a confidential assistant to President Sidney A. Ribot, who was the 16th president of Howard University. Once he decided to leave the university, I was at a point where I was not sure if I want to go ahead with the K-12 experience, because I had that experience, but I also had aspirations and I was yearning for something different, right? And so that is what led me to the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. And so I was able to marry one of my first love, which are HBCUs, and my research agenda, which shifted to assessment and accountability in higher education, because again, I was questioning if this doesn't look like me, or if I don't have these types of characteristics, what does that say about my potential regarding what I wanted to do or pursue professionally? So again, I was able to marry my first love, HBCUs, and assessment, and that is what led me to NALOA and my dear colleague and friend, Natasha Jankowski, who's the executive director of NALOA. So since then, I have been able to challenge the narrative with regard to what students are able to do based on my experience as an undergraduate at an HBCU and what the research says about what HBCUs are doing, what our alum are able to do in their communities and for their families. And so really that's how I came to become involved with assessment, and specifically looking at assessment practices and student learning at HBCUs.
Thank you both for sharing your backgrounds. Verna, what are the characteristics of historically Black colleges and universities, and how have these types of institutions evolved over time?
I think we should first even start with a formal definition of an HBCU. I believe some people think they know what HBCUs are. And so I will just really read what the Higher Education Act amended of 1965 defines an HBCU as: any historically Black college or university that was established, prior to 1964, whose principal mission was and is the education of Black Americans, and that is accredited by a nationally recognized accrediting agency or association determined by the Secretary of Education to be a reliable authority as to the quality of training offered to is, according to such an agency or association, making reasonable progress toward accreditation. Over the years and through many iterations of rigor and, you know, relevancy, HBCUs have been, you know, considered among the nation's most storied and indispensable institutions, having contributed significantly, right, to the production of the world's Black professional, intellectual, artistic, political, and entrepreneurial leaders, right? So HBCUs address indicators such as educational, economic and political, housing and health conditions of the Black community and beyond. It's also noteworthy to say that although HBCUs serve large populations of underserved or underrepresented low-income first generation, along with students of color, while also being severely underfunded, it's noteworthy to state that though we were founded to provide educational opportunities, we're not the same. We're not monolithic, right? So HBCUs include 2- and 4-year public and private land grant religious institutions. Our endowments range from a high of approximately $700 million to a little under $1 million. Our student body populations range from about 300 to almost 12,000. So it can be said that HBCUs are diverse institutions and that we share an unwavering commitment to our missions while also being providing unique learning opportunities that have sustained a Black experience in America and beyond.
Verna, you alluded to this in the previous answer, but I'd like to pick up on a thread that you mentioned. And this is, why are HBCUs important to American higher education? What impact have these institutions, and most importantly, their graduates, made in the broader society? Verna, we'll come to you first, and then we'll hear Mark's thoughts.
Yes, thank you. Thank you so much for that question, Stephen. So I will say, as far as the impact that HBCUs have made, we do not have enough time to adequately talk about the contributions. However, I will pinpoint a few. So in spite of the historical and present challenges, and those challenges include like resource inequities and funding disparities, Black graduates of HBCUs are more likely to be thriving in purpose and financial well-being. And that's based on a study that was done a few years back. I believe it was by the USA Funds and Gallup poll, 2015, if I'm not mistaken. That same study talked about HBCUs being vital to the American economy, right? Basically creating more jobs, stronger families, and stronger communities. Additionally, the economic strength stemming from those jobs is credited with creating and maintaining the Black middle class. Mark, do you want to chime in on that as well?
Yes, Verna, thank you. So as Verna has pointed out, these institutions, as diverse as they are singular in the focus of training thousands and thousands of African Americans for productive citizenship at a level that is uncompared, that cannot be compared by the production of any other institution of in higher education. If you think about the graduates and the number of those graduates who have gone into the medical field, I would say you're probably looking at, I think the last study I looked at 80% of Black doctors and dentists were trained at HBCUs at some point. Nearly 75% of African Americans that hold degrees in STEM, especially graduate degrees in STEM, have come out of HBCUs or either had some form of training at the undergraduate level at HBCUs. And so if we look at these staggering statistics, we know that the contribution is enormous. When you talk about the contribution of the Black middle class in America, both historically and in the current day, then you can also credit HBCUs for that as well. So the impact has really been enormous. And not only in terms of the production of graduates who have really transformed the industries with in which they go, but you also talk about methodology for taking students who are academically diverse and giving those students a sense of belonging, a sense of confidence, and then preparing them for lifelong careers with the limited resources that they have. There's a lot that has been learned and still to be learned from HBCUs on how to best educate people from diverse backgrounds.
And Stephen, if I may, one thing that I neglected to say earlier is that the idea that Black people were the only people in this country forbidden to read. It was against the law for Black people to learn how to read, right? And so HBCUs were the ones that actually offer an opportunity for not only to uplift yourself, but to uplift communities and generations to come. We are still benefiting from the innovative practices that have taken place since the beginning of us basically making a way for ourselves, making a way out of no way. So I think that that is definitely something that needs to be taken away from this conversation. We were, again, forbidden to read, and look at what HBCUs have been able to do to not only basically create the Black middle class, but to also offer a space for people who were not welcome in the traditional colleges and universities in the country.
Lifting up oneself, lifting up one's broader community.
Absolutely.
And certainly contributing to a sense of belonging, important contributions HBCUs are making. Issues of equity and justice are important to the higher education community. How have HBCUs been addressing these issues, and what can other institutions learn from those experiences? Mark, let's start with you for this question.
So kind of piggybacking on the last set of comments from Verna, HBCUs, and we look at our historic mission, equity is at the very core. When you talk about the inequities that Blacks suffered in America, HBCUs were leading force and the first real institution to try to establish some educational equity for Blacks by giving them opportunities to learn both trades and to learn, you know, through liberal arts education to better themselves and to be able to play more on a level playing field, even though we still got a lot of work to do, but HBCUs were the first and the strongest institutions serving that purpose. And so taking in students who may not and were not accepted, be eligible for acceptance into other institutions, but they would give those students a chance. The faculty and the staff of those institutions would provide all of the wraparound services, is what we call it today, all of the wraparound supports and services to support those students, to give them that solid foundation and give them a sense of belonging. So when you talk about equity, that's where it starts, is knowing who you are and why you are. And HBCUs have always been the voice of and both defending and instilling in African-Americans their value in society. And now if you move to contemporary times, and even though that mission and that focus of HBCUs and the role that they play was more the focus then, now we move to today, where now there are more opportunities for African-Americans to attend other institutions, other institutional types across the country and across the world. HBCUs remain persistent and consistent in supporting and filling in the gap of inequity. The leading institutions accepting Blacks from low-income communities, Blacks coming out of educational systems that have just quite frankly underserved them, and who on paper sometimes may not have the stellar credentials, but HBCUs have developed the ability to discern the capability of a student and then capitalize on those capabilities to prepare those students for participation in our society. So in terms of equity and justice, to me, that's the most important role in teaching African-Americans about their voice, teaching them about the political system and their role in it, teaching them by experience how you can represent yourself, represent your others when the society may not be, work in your favor, but how to maneuver in that political system to bring about justice. Then if you think about that whole process, the history, all of the great leaders that have played a role in civil rights, HBCUs are the foundation on which they stand. And so that has been a very important role of these institutions.
Verna, your thoughts on the same question?
Yep. Stephen, I think back to President Herman Felton's remarks at last year's Assessment Institute, when he gave a little bit about his background, where he was from. And on paper, if you only consider what he looked like on paper, who knows where he would be today. And I think with regard to equity, someone at that institution, his undergraduate institution, which was Edward Waters College in Jacksonville, Florida, knew that he was more than his story on paper, right? What he looked like, what he would be able to provide, not only to his family, not only to his community, but to the nation, right? So consider his story being a young man who just did not have the proper influences around him, could have strayed away, but now he is leading an institution. He is actually the second president. He's in his second presidency. His first presidency was at Wilberforce, which is in Ohio. And now he is leading Wiley College in Texas. That talks to the equitable practices that go on at HBCUs, and also recognizing the fact that we are experts of our own experience.
Turning now to HBCU CEQA, we'd like to learn more about its purpose and mission and the audience that it serves. So Mark, we'll come to you first for the purpose and mission, followed by Verna, a discussion of the audience. Mark.
Great. Thank you for the question, Stephen. So HBCU CEQA was established to leverage the collective expertise of assessment professionals and institutional effectiveness professionals at HBCUs to promote the use of best practices in assessment and evaluation to demonstrate the effectiveness of HBCUs in achieving our common missions. So our goal is to serve as a collective work group to address common challenges to HBCUs and to draft common solutions to those challenges.
So that's a little bit about the purpose and mission. Verna, the audience that the association, or the I should say, the audience that the collaborative seeks to serve.
Yep. So just a little bit more as far as who we are and who we serve, right? So we are now at 36 member institutions. We have 5 national organizations who are members. We have approximately 80 members, individual members, and we are 100% committed to our vision and our mission. I want to also talk about some of the our reach, right? So we've had, since our founding, we've had about 14 articles published by our members. So I Great. Want to mention my alma mater, a very, very talented young man who's been there about 2 years now. His name is Dr. Glenn Phillips at Howard University, along with Dr. Rebecca Graham. She's at the University of District of Columbia. They are fairly new members to CEQA, and they have been very, very vocal with regard to honoring traditions while doing this assessment work at their institutions. I want to also mention Dr. Amelia Parnell, who's a member as well. She's a vice president at NASPA. We have President Kevin James, who was just announced as the 19th president of Morris Brown College, who's a member of CEQA. We have Dr. Melba Williams, who is a really, really influential young lady in the student affairs space. She's a vice president at Southern University. She was also a co-founder of the Higher Education Leadership Fund, who recently was granted a 3-year partnership with the United Negro College Fund, and also Dr. Howard Gibson at Wiley College, who was just named as Academic Affairs, the Vice President for Academic Affairs at Wiley College. And as you can see, as far as our audience, we have members from across the country, mostly in the southern states, but our reach is across the nation. So I believe that our influence is rooted in our goals of being the go-to resource for any assessment and institutional effectiveness needs and challenges and opportunities that we have in the HBCU space.
The go-to resource. So let's pick that theme up, Verna, and talk about some of the resources, events, and services that HBCU CEQA offers the higher education community.
Well, I think I should first say that HBCU CEQA meets twice a year, right? We have a summer convening, usually in Atlanta, and then we meet at the Assessment Institute that you have so graciously been supportive of these last 3 years. So with these meetings twice a year, we get together to highlight assessment and evaluation practices that are used at our member institutions, right? It's an opportunity for us to collaborate with our peers and counterparts from other HBCUs, to propose different solutions and common assessment challenges. We also get together to participate in innovative professional development, network, and identify scholarly collaboration. And that goes back to my comment before, where we don't just meet just to say we're convening. We're actually meeting to uplift one another. We're leading to make sure that we are doing what we say we're going to do, which is be the go-to resource. And if we're going to be the go-to resource, we need to be experts at best practices. So that is the main focus of our two convenings in the summer and at the Assessment Institute in mid-fall.
Mark, your thoughts on some of the resources and services offered by HBCU CEQA.
So again, because it's primarily a collaborative work group for assessment and evaluation and effectiveness of professionals, our greatest resource and tool to our members is one another. I will say that we have some of the most talented assessment professionals and institutional effectiveness professionals in higher education, working at HBCUs. And so being a resource to each other, I think is our greatest tool for one another, because then we're able again to address common solutions to the challenges that all institutions of higher education face, but we are working as a brother and sister institutions with those professors working to strengthen one another. Although we are very fierce rivals on the basketball courts and the football fields, but when it comes to the vitality of this body of institutions, we are united in that way. And at the core of our commitment to one another are the commitments we have among our CEQA professionals. And so that would be our greatest resource to our members. The greatest resource we offer to our institutions and other institutions of higher learning and also other higher education partner institutions as well is that we leverage, because we are the lifeline of data and information and outcomes for the institutions, is that we leverage all of the information, the data that we have in institutions and the expertise that we have to better tell the story of HBCUs. There are a lot of different stories out there about the role of HBCUs and how that role and the value of HBCUs have changed over time, but that story is being told by those outside of HBCUs. So what we do is we empower the presidents, the vice presidents, the provost, and the marketing teams of HBCUs to put out accurate stories about the value and the impact of our institutions in the terms that we control. And that is also one of our greatest assets that we offer to the larger higher education community abroad.
Mark and Stephen, I would not even feel okay with not mentioning our fantastic leadership team. As far as better telling our story and the core of our commitment, our leadership team, which includes Mark as our chair, I'm the co-chair. We have a very talented young man named Franz Renault at Georgia Tech. And we have a very, very talented young lady, Chantel Stanford, and she is at the Interdenominational Theological Center in Atlanta. That team was actually recently featured on the White House Initiative on HBCUs last September, almost a year ago. And with regard to the core of our commitment, we are not only giving agency to our members to tell our story, we are being a resource for HBCU presidents, HBCU leaders, HBCU staff members, people who are on the ground doing the work. We are the resource. And I just wanted to shout out our leadership team for being pivotal in that message about getting our story, getting the correct story out about teaching, student learning outcomes, and educational experiences that happen on HBCU campuses.
I'd like to take this opportunity to invite our listeners to visit the website of HBCU CEQA, and it's been graciously housed at Mark
Houses Institution, the Morehouse School of Medicine. That website, msm.edu/OEOA/CEQA. I'll repeat that one more time. It's msm.edu/OEOA/CEQA, C-E-E-Q-A. And Mark, thanks to you and your colleagues for hosting the plentiful resources at your institution's website.
Yes. So it's been a pleasure. Morehouse School of Medicine, along with several, I think it was 10 institutions that were part of the founding group of members for CEQA, and all of us and our institutions have been supportive of this HBCU CEQA initiative. My president, Dr. Valerie Montgomery Rice, is a big fan of CEQA, and so she allows us and my entire team at the institution to support CEQA in any way that we can.
Verna, I'd also like to thank you and Mark for the contributions you both have made and those of your colleagues to our special edition of Assessment Update in the September-October 2020 issue focused on assessment in HBCUs. In fact, HBCU CEQA is well represented in that particular issue. So thanks to you, thanks to Mark, thanks to all of your colleagues for contributing solicitations for that special edition.
Absolutely. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you. We're very excited about it and look forward to sharing that piece of work with the broader community.
For listeners who'd like to learn more about Assessment Update, including that special edition, please consult our website, assessmentinstitute.iupui.edu/AU. Lots of people get together and talk, but HBCU CEQA has been busy these past 3 years. So I want to ask Marco, come to you first. What happens next? What's on the agenda in the coming years? What are your plans? And Verna will follow up with you.
So, and as you can see, Verna has all of the technical details about the operation. They just let me come to the meetings and talk with Verna. And I really want to thank Verna and Chantel and Franz, the leadership team, and all of our members. And all of them are very eager. We all work together to get this done. But I really want to thank them for their commitment to this effort. So in the future, we are planning to launch a webinar series, which we'll be launching soon for our members. And so those webinars are primarily for our members, but others will be able to join. And we are very excited about that. We're working on a set of publications that will be coming out about the work that we're doing. And we'll also be building and putting together a toolkit that will be shared among our members as well. So tools that will help them to be more effective and efficient in their job and continuing our professional development series for our CEQA members as well. So we're very, very, very excited about that. We have aggressive plans to strengthen the organization of CEQA, to even secure funding to support this initiative. And so we are laying the groundwork for expanding our structure, expanding our membership. We have members that are excited to join CEQA almost on a daily basis. And so we are just trying to structure ourselves for the pace at which we're growing.
Absolutely, Mark. And, you know, I literally just got an inquiry about becoming a member late last night of CEQA. So, Stephen, when I tell you that we are experiencing unprecedented growth, we are cautiously trekking ahead. We are very, very excited about our next steps. But also one of the things that we agreed on as a leadership team is we want to have as strong of a foundation as we can before we move forward with this very, very important work, because it's too important to get it wrong, right? And to answer your question regarding where we're seeing HBCU CEQA in the coming years. And one of the things that I continuously push, there was an article a couple of years ago by Dr. Bridget Terry Long. She's the the dean at the Harvard Graduate School of Education. She's an economist. She talked about something like grading higher education or giving consumers what they want. And what she talks about is, while beneficial and important, higher education is an expensive investment, right? So she talks about tools regarding return on investments being incomplete. And although Bridget was talking about in terms of money, like expenses, debts, and defaults, I believe that colleges and universities must be ready to make an argument and convince people that those institutions is worth the cost, right? So time, effort, and future opportunities. And that is where CEQA is really, really making a dent in the research, because we are consistently showing that an HBCU education not only positively affects one generation, it's the gift that keeps on giving, right? So we're looking at research and presentations regarding the return on investment and making it make sense for people to know that HBCU investment is worth the cost, right? Another thing that we are looking forward to is making sure that the most important thing or responsibility that all of us have a role in is ensuring that institutions meet requirements to remain accredited, right? because losing accreditation means that these institutions may lose federal funding, which a lot of the students depend on to attend institutions. And what CEQA has begun the work of doing is at our summer convening last year, our members took 2 days to basically draft a report to talk about who HBCUs are, who we serve, and what we are trying to communicate. And what this has done over a year, through many iterations, we have come up with a draft of a peer reviewer training document. And basically, this document is going to be disseminated to every HBCU in the country so that before accrediting teams and peer reviewers come to their campuses, they know who they are looking at. They know who HBCUs are, because again, a lot of people, that's why I started with the definition of the HBCU. People assume that they know what we are, what we do, who we are, but we are giving them this is who we are. So before you come with, you know, the standard of what is appropriate and what is not, here is who we are. This is what we stand on, and this is our mission. And again, we have disseminated to a few people. A few presidents have looked over the document, and when it's in a place where we all are comfortable with saying that it's worthy to be disseminated, we are looking forward to that day. So again, so to wrap up what I just said, we're looking forward to talking about the return on investment and making sure people understand that this HBCU experience is worth the cost, and also our role in making sure that we remain accredited. But with that accrediting, we are educating people on who HBCUs are and not what they think HBCUs are and who we serve.
Mark, how are HBCUs responding to the COVID-19 pandemic? What are you hearing from your members?
Well, Stephen, as you can imagine, it's a very fluid situation, and we're dealing with the same challenges at our institutions that other institutions are facing. However, because of the diverse range of resources available to our institutions, some institutions are impacted more severely than others because of that. And so we're very, 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 very attentive and concerned about our sister institutions and how they are navigating this kind of new normal that we are facing. But the responses vary across institutions, across the type, across their funding sources, and so forth. A lot of our HBCUs are private institutions, and of course, are dealing with some of the financial impact of COVID, because they have decided, in the best interest and the safety of students, to not bring students back to campus and to educate those students in a virtual environment. then that means that now you are not bringing in the receipts that you get from housing and from running the cafeterias and having students on the campus. And so they're adjusting their financial structures and practices to be able to weather a semester and even, maybe even a year with no students on campus. Other institutions are bringing students back to campus through various structures that less like other institutions where you have A, B, and C groups and you're rotating those students on campus in a hybrid face-to-face slash virtual training model and finding ways to do that while maintaining social distancing and protecting students. I know what we're here at Morehouse School of Medicine because we are training health professionals and we realize the president realized that while it would be nice for our students to stay home and to be out of the hospitals and out of the clinics, but they have to be trained to deal with these and any future pandemics that we might have. And so we are finding ways to get our students back into the hospitals, back into the clinics and engaging with patients. But we're doing so with an extreme focus on their protection, making sure they have the PPE and the other training to protect themselves and their families while we do this and educate them. So the response has varied. One of the things that we're also excited about, though, is that HBCUs are playing very important roles in solutions to COVID. For example, here at Morehouse School of Medicine and at Meharry and at Howard, the medical schools, they are actually leading the research and testing of vaccines and playing a very, very, very important role. When you talk about contact tracing and the best models for those, and especially this is just not something new for us going into our own communities and trying to map out movement of people and practices, the cultural experiences of people. Well, that's something HBCU specializes in. We've been doing it since our inception. And so we're leading the way in terms of developing new strategies for contact tracing and for tracking and slowing the spread of the disease. So we're playing a very important role in the country's efforts to find solutions to COVID. So we are very excited about that. And I knew you may have heard, but Morehouse School of Medicine also received a $40 million grant from Google in this regard. And so our researchers, our scientists are on the front lines trying to make our nation better on the other side of this COVID pandemic.
As we look ahead over the next few years, what are some of the major trends shaping higher education, and how is HBCU CEQA positioning itself to address some of those trends? Mark, let me begin with you, and then we'll hear from Verna.
Well, again, you know, this is unprecedented times. And as you can see, the renewed focus and almost historic focus on social justice and equity, then this is where sometimes the tide has shifted, where this is something HBCUs have been doing for years, since our inception. And so the trend, I think, is going to be very, very dependent upon how we as a society handle and go through the tough conversations that we're going to have to go through as a country, as we talk about racial tensions and inequity, the economic inequities that we encounter in the country and how we're going to solve those. And HBCU is going to play a very important role in providing the expertise and in framing the conversation. And our graduates are already playing very, very important roles in this particular conversation. And not only that, when you think about the technological innovations that are taking place, and as I stated earlier, our graduates, we 70 to 80% of the Blacks and underrepresented persons that's operating and working in the STEM field, 70 to 80% of them have had some form of training at HBCUs, and will continue to contribute to technological innovations. But what I would anticipate over the next 5 years is that we'll see a increase in the amounts of innovation, the research that we're doing at our institutions, and the fingerprint on the footprint of HBCUs expanding greatly on this front as well.
Thank you for that, Mark. I wanted to reiterate one of the facts that you just talked about, Mark, where HBCUs having a significant impact on Black professional educational successes, particularly in the STEM fields. I pulled up a few of the statistics here, where noticed that 15% of engineering degrees, 25% of biological science degrees, 28% of agricultural science degrees, and 26% of math degrees are awarded at HBCUs, which is a significant stance with regard to major trends that are shaping higher education. I wanted to also talk more about non-traditional students who are returning and unprecedented numbers, right, to campuses across the country. These are non-traditional students, interestingly enough, are actually the traditional student now. They outnumber the traditional 18 to 22 year old who came right out of high school and never really had a job. So as far as CEQA is concerned and influencing the narrative on non-traditional students, we are going to be shifting the narrative with regard to being the consumers of this type of research to actually the producers of this research, because we have been doing it since, like Mark said, since the founding of our institutions. Along with that, the competency-based, or I believe it's a learning recognition initiative, is really, really, really significant in the space now. Like, not necessarily the credentials that you have at this point, but what are you able to do, right? And taking that information, and how do you get a credential out of it, right? Or a certificate, and we would translate that certificate into money, and that money into being able to provide for your family. So that's what I would say as far as major trends that are concerned that CEQA is going to be making more of an influence on is the non-traditional students who make up the traditional student now, the majority of students who are on U.S. campuses now, specifically at HBCUs, and also the competency-based learning recognition of what you are able to do and how we're able to put that on a transcript so that you can go about your life and provide for your families, right? Another thing, and I'll stop here, are the pathways that we're really trying to get a better handle on is the pathways from K-12 public schools to college, learning the language of college, learning the language of what a syllabus says. So for instance, if you see on a professor's syllabus, office hours, that means that you are able to actually go visit the professor at those hours, as opposed to there was a big Twitter feed a couple of months ago where one professor said, I need to change my syllabus because one of the students told me that he thought the office hours means you cannot disturb me during those hours. And so we are really looking at how we are able to influence the dialogue and change the narrative on the things that we have been able to do and being able to basically translate so that families and students are able to recognize what we're talking about so that they can go about their business of being a productive student.
So, Stephen, I would just like to add to Verna's comments. And so when you think about all of this, the things that both Verna and I just mentioned, and then you think about where we're trying to position CEQA to be the as Verna said, the go-to institution when it comes to the impact and effectiveness of HBCUs, then we are, again, trying to strengthen one another, all of the assessment professionals, making sure that they are employing best practices in talking about the impact of their institutions, but not only the impact in terms of student learning, but the capabilities of the institutions. There are our research scientists and their capabilities. There may be people out there that have a notion that that these are not research level institutions, but many of our institutions and some of the best research scientists in their fields in the world work at HBCUs. And so we have to raise the awareness of that so that that machinery can be used in finding solutions to real world and future world problems. And so HBCU CEQA is working to raise the notoriety of HBCUs and their capability. We are partners with a STEMUS, a grant that was really just announced a couple of days ago, that was awarded to Morehouse College, which is our sister institution here in Atlanta. And HBCU CEQA is a strategic partner with STEMUS. The focus on the purpose of STEMUS is just what I just said, is to raise the awareness of the STEM productivity and capability at HBCUs. And so we are working in a very formal way with STEMUS in this regard.
As we draw our time together to a close, let me ask both of you, we'll start with Verna, for a final thought you'd like to leave with our listeners.
Before I do that, Stephen, I want to sincerely thank you again for your support of HBCU CEQA. I would also like to thank my colleagues at the National Institute for Learning Outcomes Assessment, specifically our executive director, Natasha Jankowski, for entrusting me with this very, very important work. I'd like to thank my colleague who joined me today, Mark House, for, you know, all of the long talks about really trying to create something that we know that is super important, but also making an impact for generations to come that we won't be around to know how it has truly impacted those people. So thank you, Mark, for that. And as far as the listeners are concerned, I also think that it's important that they know that even in the midst of a pandemic, an economic depression, and recently in just relentless violence and racial threats against Black Americans, HBCUs continue to be the hub for imagination and ideas to thrive. We are shifting the narrative, not from how to, but how we are the leaders of our own experiences. And we want to encourage everyone to support and uplift HBCU support financially, resources, internships, collaboration, because they are going to be the leading catalyst for change in America and beyond.
And Mark, from you, a final thought.
Yes. Again, I want to thank you again, Stephen, for allowing us to share with you today and to speak to your audience about the work that we're doing at HBCU CEQA. We are very excited about where we are going, and we want, number one, to our members to say thank you for just being a part of CEQA. We also want to invite those that are interested in those both organizations, institutions, and individuals that see this as a worthy cause. We welcome you to join us in this worthwhile endeavor. HBCUs are one of America's treasures, one of the greatest treasures we have in America. And we want to make sure that everybody knows about the story of HBCUs, but more importantly, that we capitalize on the power, on the passion, on the commitment of HBCUs to make this country the best country in the world. And when it comes to racial equality, economic justice, social justice, HBCUs have been the tip of the spear and will continue to be the tip of the spear in this fight. And so we take our hats off to HBCUs and the work that they have done. The imprint on the world cannot even be valued. And so we must love and treasure these great institutions. Again, thank you for the opportunity to be here.
Well, it is I who needs to be thanking both of you for your time with us today. And I'm especially grateful for the partnership we have between HBCU CEQA and the Assessment Institute. Thank you, Mark. Thank you, Verna. We have been speaking today with Verna Orr and Mark House of HBCU CEQA. And again, that stands for the Historically Black Colleges and Universities Collaborative for Excellence in Educational Quality Assurance. Again, that's HBCU CEQA. Thanks so much, Mark. Thanks so much, Verna.
Thank you.
My pleasure. Thank you.
This has been Leading Improvements in Higher Education. Our sponsor for this season is Watermark. Learn more at watermarkinsights.com. This podcast is a service of the Assessment Institute in Indianapolis, and you can learn more at our website, assessmentinstitute.iupui.edu, where you can also access other episodes. Our producers are Chad Beckner, Caleb Keith, and Shirley Yorger, with original music composed by Caleb Keith. If you like our podcast, please spread the word and encourage others to give us a listen. We appreciate your support. I'm Stephen Hundley from IUPUI, inviting you to join us again for Leading Improvements in Higher Education.